I'm Christopher Lydon with Lawrence Wright. He's the New Yorker magazine reporter who's become a main source on peace and war in the Middle East. First in his book, The Looming Tower, about the roots of Al-Qaeda and modern jihadism, and now in his minute-by-minute account of Jimmy Carter's Camp David summit in 1978 with two sometime terrorists, Prime Minister Menachem Begin of Israel and President Anwar Sadat of Egypt. And of course, there's the lone survivor, Jimmy Carter, the unpopular populist from Georgia, who felt that God wanted him to bring peace to the Holy Land. Small wonder that Larry Wright wrote this story first as a stage play, 13 Days in September, it's called. Feels like generals almost at war, screaming contests, role reversals, threats to go home, pillow-talking wives, and hair-splitting staffs. But those 13 days produced the only and still unviolated peace agreement between Arabs and Israelis, ever. And for all the gaping flaws in the treaty, no mention of Palestinians, for example, and despite the high price the principals paid, assassination for Sadat, re-election defeat for Jimmy Carter, Larry Wright forces you to wonder, wouldn't war have been infinitely worse? And then also to ask, why do we assume that the causes of this kind of conflict cannot be talked down?
This was an event that was doomed for failure from the start. Carter had a really mistaken idea when he got Begin and Sadat together. He thought, these are two honorable men. I'll just take them up on that wooded mountaintop in Maryland. They'll get to know each other. They'll like each other. They'll trust each other, and they'll find their own way to peace. And after the second day, he had to physically separate them. They could not be together. They couldn't stand each other. Rosalind Carter said she could hear them screaming at the top of their lungs. And, you know, there was no way they could make peace with each other. So on the fifth day, Carter had to do something he really didn't want to do, which was to put forward an American plan. And he had a legal pad, a yellow legal pad, and he wrote out 30 areas that needed to be resolved. And that was the first of 23 drafts of the American plan. He was constantly trying to shave down the differences. And both parties, both Sadat and Begin, threatened on various occasions to leave. One time, Sadat had ordered the helicopter. He packed his bags. And Carter told me he had never been angrier in his life. And he went to Sadat and he said, if you do this, America and Egypt will have no relations. Our friendship will be at an end. And Egypt will be alone and helpless in the world. It was a real come to Jesus moment from an expert on that subject. And then Begin, a couple of times, was planning to leave. And Carter told him, if you do this, I will tell the American people who's responsible. I will tell the Congress tomorrow that these talks collapsed because of your obstinance and your inability to make peace. He even had one of his speechwriters draw up a speech in which Carter asked the Israeli people to vote down their government. So this was a turning point because both parties, neither party could make peace with each other, but suddenly their relationship with the United States was on the line, and they could make concessions to the U.S. that they couldn't make to each other.
I mean, there's so many ironies that hang over this huge accomplishment in diplomatic effort. You say it's a almost uniquely successful negotiation. It's never been violated, the terms of the agreement.
The portion between Egypt and Israel in 35 years.
I mean, you could surely use this as a reason to don't tell your kid to be a diplomat. I mean, you could get assassinated. You could get voted out of office. Yeah. You could have, you know, an Iranian revolution happen while you're not looking.
Yeah.
Not to mention, I mean, it's always seemed to me terrifically ironic that Jimmy Carter gave Israel its longest peace with its most important neighbor, and he's vilified, demonized. He's radioactive, as they say, in Israel to this day. I mean, what went wrong?
Well, this whole business of making peace is unusual and hard. There's a reason why it's so rare. It's extremely easy to start wars, but making peace is, you know, between two warring parties, very unusual. Hal Saunders, who was a Undersecretary of State and was at Camp David, when this just before this began, he went down to the State Department historian and said, "Has this ever happened before?" And the historian said, yeah, Teddy Roosevelt. And when the Russians and the Japanese were at war, it was the first great war of the 20th century. Roosevelt brought envoys from each side to the Portsmouth Naval Station, you know, secluded, and hammered out a resolution between these two warring parties. And he became the first American to win the Nobel Peace Prize. But beyond that, there's not any other example in American history. Later, George Mitchell in Northern Ireland would be a good example. But in the past, my favorite example was in the 15th century. I think it was Pope, Pope Alexander the Fifth or Sixth. Spain and Portugal were warring over, they were dividing the world up between them. And so the Pope thoughtfully drew a line across the globe and gave the New World to Spain and Africa to Portugal. But the line that he drew, he had an inadequate map, and he didn't realize that Brazil stuck out in across the line, and that's why they speak Portuguese in Brazil to this day.
Barack Obama is trying to advocate peace without victory all over the place nowadays. I mean, is it a viable idea?
Well, he's now leading us back into war, and my feeling is that, you know, if you look at the Middle East, everybody feels so discouraged, and the idea that Arabs and Jews can make peace seems ridiculous. You know, most people feel like they're eternal enemies, but Camp David shows us that that's not true, that peace can be made between these two peoples. We're in a spot right now where I think the drift of events is really dangerous. The conversation in between Palestinians and Israel has become so strident, and you know the talk of annihilation is very disturbing to me. And yet, you think about all the missing moments and the different mindsets, like when and Begin was the most radically conservative figure that Israel had ever had at that point. He wanted to annex the West Bank, which he called Judea and Samaria, but he was going to award full citizenship to any Arab who wanted it. You know, it was essentially a one-state solution, something that you couldn't imagine gaining much ground in Israel right now. 25 years ago, you could drive from Gaza to Golan Heights without a single checkpoint. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, 100,000 from Gaza alone, went to work in Israel every day. You know, it's hard to conceive of that now because people have become, they don't know each other anymore. And they've dehumanized each other in their respective neighborhoods so greatly that it just doesn't occur to them that there's another way of resolving this. And this region is crying out for reconciliation and not more war.
What's driving the alienation, this extreme polarization, separation, hatred?
You know, when the nuances are lost and the actual encounters with each other, you know, the ability to see each other as human beings, when that disappears, then people are allowed to hate each other. And hatred is a very luxurious emotion. It's fun to hate people. You can put all the evil in the world on top of someone else's shoulders. And you can deny their ability to make peace or their love for peace. Mm. You can say that they'll never accept it. And that's the state of mind that I find so much now in the Middle East.
There are other things to note here. I mean, to me, the example of an American president staring down the leaders of the Israeli and the Egyptian nation, perfectly ready to yell at them, perfectly ready to correct them, stay on the case. You're not leaving this room. Yeah. I'm going to tell you something. And our relationship, the American relationship with your country, is at stake here. Nobody's done that for a long time, and it works. Yeah. I mean, one of the things you conclude about both Sadat and Begin is that they were they were mad to maintain and improve their relationship with right. Uncle Sam.
Yeah, they believed that he was right when he said that your relationship with the U.S. was on the line. I don't know how much either Sadat or Begin believed when they went to Camp David they would come out with peace. But both of them had an interest in maintaining their relationship with the U.S. Sadat wanted to... He and Carter were very good friends. Carter used to say he loved Anwar Sadat. It's a term you don't normally hear in international diplomacy.
Romance.
But they were very close friends. And he hoped that the relationship between the U.S. and Egypt could come to resemble that friendship, and that maybe even it would overshadow the U.S. relationship with Israel. You know, that was his grand ambition. Whether, you know, Begin could make peace or not, the main thing he wanted to come out was with an improved relationship with the U.S. And Begin, he was only thinking he was going to be there a couple of days. He never expected to surrender Sinai, but he never would, except that suddenly Carter put America's thumb on the scale. And, you know, after Camp David, many Jews said that Carter had bullied Israel. And that, you know, he became the first Democratic nominee when he was running for re-election not to have a majority of the Jewish vote. So this antipathy toward Carter that you see so strongly expressed in many circles really began then when Begin said that he had been forced to sign. Yet Begin wanted peace and Sadat wanted peace. They had to have a party that would force them to do this. You know, if you go to Israel and Egypt, you'll hear how unloved this peace treaty is by both sides. But to me, that just indicates how hard it was, what, you know, the sacrifices they had to make in order to achieve it.
Come back to this Sadat piece, which runs through your book as a kind of hint that, wait a sec, for Sadat, this is all about making a big geostrategic switch. Yeah. The Soviets are gone, Nasser's gone, he wants to marry the United States, and this is what he's going to have to do. There are moments when he says, do what you want with the Palestinian thing. If you'll give me back the Sinai, I'll do anything you want.
Yeah.
This is a man who, as you're right, had wanted to be an actor. He was a dramatic personality, believed in all sorts of transformations and whatnot. But the transformation he was really interested in was in the American connection.
Well, you know, Sadat saw himself in pharaonic terms, as is typical of Egyptian leaders, unfortunately. There's always this idea that there's, you know, a need for a strong man. And I was living in Cairo. I was teaching at the American University when Sadat became president. And everybody thought he was a clown. He had missed the revolution. He'd been at the movie theater, a double feature. But, but you know, nobody believed that in the shadow of Gamal Abdel Nasser, one of the most titanic figure in Arab history, that, you know, that Sadat could stand in the wind. And yet within a year he'd taken all of Nasser's corrupt cronies and put them in prison. There were no diplomatic relations with the U.S. at that time, so there were only a couple of hundred Americans in the whole country, but there were thousands of Russians and 15,000 Soviet military advisors, and he threw them in out of the country, and that was stunning and unprompted. You know, the Americans couldn't believe it. It was one of the greatest victories in the Cold War, and we had nothing to do with it.
But it let Egypt become a sort of showplace for crony capitalism too, especially under Mubarak and his sons. I mean, this has to be counted among the effects of Camp David.
Yeah, Egypt, when I lived there, was a very poor country, and it is now a less poor country with a lot of wealth that wasn't there before.
Double the population.
You know, when I lived in Cairo, there were 6 million people, and of course, it's always an estimate, you know, guesstimate.
Right.
In Egypt.
Over 20.
Immense growth. No, it's 2006. I was there, and I was making a speech at at Cairo University, where Barack Obama later made his famous speech. And a young woman asked me, what happened to Egypt? Why didn't we progress?
Amen.
And when I was there, you know, Egypt was about on the same level as South Korea, India, Singapore even. These were all developing countries, and they developed, and Egypt really did not. And I said, I think it takes a generation. Just as, you know, in the Great Depression in my country, my father was on the Dust Bowl in Kansas, and then, you know, that greatest generation, as we call them, really transformed America into the most powerful economy the world has ever known. And similar generations are there in Hong Kong and Indonesia. You know, you see all these countries raising up. It's going to take a generation like that in Egypt. And I think that generation went into Tahrir Square. And I don't think they're finished yet. There is a revolution that is yet to be finished in Egypt. And I hope and pray that it comes about.
Yeah. All I mean to say is it's a revolution in some part against all sorts of things that Anwar Sadat embodied, as well as the beauty of the man and his daring.
Yeah. But now, on the other hand, just consider that Egypt and Israel, as little loved as this treaty is, those two countries are closer together now than they ever have been. And it wouldn't have been possible without that treaty.
Now, let's say some more good things about this treaty. Whether it succeeds in detail or not, it elevates the ideal of peace.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to be fashionable at the moment, but the peacemakers survive in some great hall of fame.
Well, they should certainly be there. And you look at the men that went to Camp David, and, you know, we often talk about the need for partners for peace. But if you think about them, there was Anwar Sadat, who had been a Nazi collaborator and spy. He was a great admirer of Hitler.
That was only because he hated the Brits so much, right?
Well, even after World War II, after 50 million people are dead, he continued to express his admiration for Hitler. He had been an assassin. You know, he joined this little murder society, as he called it, which was mainly at the time when he joined it, they were picking off British soldiers who were wandering alone and drunk in the streets of Cairo at night. But he turned their attention to political assassination. And he went to prison for 5 years before escaping. But this was Anwar Sadat. And then Menachem Begin was a terrorist leader. He was the head of Irgun. And, you know, he had bombed the King David Hotel and killed 91 people. He had, after succeeding in driving the British out of Palestine, he turned his attention to the Palestinians and, you know, most notably attacked this little village of Deir Yassin. It was a massacre. And it opened the floodgates for the Palestinian exodus. 750,000 Palestinians left Israel at that time, and the gates closed behind them. And then finally, Jimmy Carter, who was a weak and unpopular president, besieged by double-digit inflation. Prime rate was 20%. Remember the gas lines and stagflation? The
misery index.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, horrible. And the Shah was going down. It was in the middle of midterm elections. So all of these things were on their shoulders, and yet they went to Camp David, these three very flawed individuals, and somehow they exceeded themselves. I think the one quality they had in common was their political courage.
Hmm. You could argue that the Camp David peace was not healthy for Menachem Begin once he got home. He didn't have to worry about the Egyptians anymore. He was not bound on settlements or confronting the Palestinians, and this is where the war in Lebanon comes, and eventually the, talk about massacres, Sabra Shatila in Beirut in 1982. You could say that the peace liberated the dark side of Menachem Begin, and there was lots of it.
Yeah, I think you can also say he was betrayed by his generals, who led him to believe that it was only going to take a couple of days to go into Lebanon and clean out the PLO, and they were there for 18 years. It was a disaster. A disaster for Israel and for Lebanon and for Begin, who was, you know, haunted. 400,000 people came into the streets you know, at the time, 10% of the Israeli population, and protesting the Lebanon invasion. Mm. And they used to stand outside the prime minister's residence all night long, very much like during Lyndon Johnson during Vietnam. And Begin would not allow the police to push them aside, but he finally resigned from his office and went into seclusion for the last 9 years of his life. I think he paid a terrible price and made a huge mistake.
Back to the woods of Maryland.
Yeah.
All these people scurrying around, Brzezinski and assistants of all kinds, holy men, weirdos, wives, coaches, masseurs.
It was an amazing scene. There were more than 100 people there. And the delegates were a very mixed bag. The Egyptians were almost entirely united against Sadat. They did not want him to make peace.
Sounds like Reagan at Reykjavik.
It was got to the level, they were so angry with him, that at one point Carter believed that they were going to kill him. He woke up at 4 in the morning. He got Brzezinski, who was in his pajamas, to reinforce the security around Sadat's cabin because Carter had decided that the delegates were, the Egyptian delegates were going to kill their own leader at Camp David. And the Israeli delegates were like the mirror opposite. You had, you know, Moshe Dayan, you know, this iconic legend, Israeli, greatest Israeli warrior ever, and Ezra Weissman, who had built the Israeli Air Force. And these guys, you know, constantly pressuring Begin to be more flexible, trying to steer him towards peace. And they're all wandering around in this wooded hilltop in Maryland, most of them with very little to do. Because it was really Carter who was staying up, you know, he and his team every night drafting again and again, you know, going back and forth to these different delegations. Weissman watched Patton, you know, like 10 times, you know, at the movie theater waiting for some new development. You know, it's ironic to me with all the, you know, geopolitical strategizing that was going on. I think Begin, who was so obstinate, I think he was terrified. He'd lost his family in the Holocaust. He felt his entire career, his responsibility was to save the Jewish people and to expand the land of Israel. So giving back land was like the most difficult thing possible for him. And, you know, they'd made that deal on Saturday night, the last Saturday night, and the Sunday, the day of the signing, there was a side letter that Carter had written. Sadat had asked him to clarify the American position on East Jerusalem. And so there are a lot of side letters, and they have no legal standing. But he wrote a letter reaffirming the American position as stated by three former American UN ambassadors going back to Arthur Goldberg that East Jerusalem was occupied territory. So this letter lands in Begin's hands that Sunday, and he tells Carter, "You must withdraw this. You've betrayed me." And Carter's befuddled, you know, this has no standing. This is just the American position. It's not my position. It's the historic American position. But he said, "If you don't withdraw this, then the signing is off and no agreement." And Carter had promised Sadat, he said, "I can't go back on that." So Begin blew it up. The networks had already been alerted that the president was going to interrupt the broadcast of the Emmys that night. They were setting up the table and the chairs in the East Room of the White House. And Carter went back to his cabin feeling more depressed than he'd ever been in his life. Talks weren't just a failure. They were a fiasco. So it happened that there was a photograph taken of the three men sitting on the porch of Aspen Lodge, which was a presidential cabin. And Carter had thoughtfully gotten copies made up for Begin's 9 grandchildren. And his secretary had called Israel and gotten the names of the children. And so Carter had inscribed them and signed it, "Love, Jimmy Carter." And he realized he had to take the pictures back to Begin, and he really didn't want to see Begin ever again. And Begin received him absolutely frigidly. You know, it was no relationship at all. And, you know, essentially the conversation was, thank you, goodbye, Mr. President. Carter handed him the manila envelope, and Begin looked inside to see the photograph, and he noticed that it was, the first one was inscribed to his granddaughter, Michal, and then to his grandson, Yonatan. And he began to weep. And Carter also began to cry. And Carter said, I had hoped to write, this is where your grandfather and I made peace in the Middle East. And then he went back to his cabin to tell Sadat that the signing was off. And the phone rang, and Begin said he would sign.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah. It's amazing to think that such human moments can, in the balance of things, make such a difference.
Lawrence, I want to read you just a little fragment. It's just wisdom out of the ages, and it's quoting my secular guide, Ralph Waldo Emerson, on friendship. But it gets at a point that I think bears on Israelis and Arabs and all of us. What is so delicious as a just and firm encounter of two in a thought, in a feeling? And he goes on to talk about all the yearning, as you speak of it, for friendship, for reconciliation. Mm-hmm. He goes on, we have a great deal more kindness than is ever spoken. Barring all the selfishness that chills like east winds the world, the whole human family is bathed with an element of love like a fine ether. How many persons we meet in houses, whom we scarcely speak to, whom yet we honor, and who honor us. How many we see in the street or sit with in church, whom, though silently, we warmly rejoice to be with. I felt this in Israel, in Egypt, all over the place, on streets in Boston. Mm-hmm. We love each other deep down. And Egyptians love Israelis. And it doesn't take a lot of work to surface a complete, ironic, laughing understanding of how human those other monsters are. I just wonder, what in the world could surface that absolutely powerful human reality? For all the contention, all the political, you know, feisty battling, there's a bigger reality out there.
I had an idea at one point. It was maybe mistaken, but DNA evidence has demonstrated that the Palestinians and the Jews are essentially the same people. They're both descended from the Canaanites. And genetically, you know, very, very similar people. And there was a theory that David Ben-Gurion, who was the first Israeli prime minister, and Yitzhak Ben-Zvi, who was the second president, they wrote a book when they were living in New York. And essentially they were postulating that the Palestinians are Jews, that when Nebuchadnezzar raided the Israelite kingdom and took all the Jews with money and talents to Babylon for 70 years until they were freed by Cyrus the Great. He didn't take all the Jews. There were Jews that still remained. And so the question that Ben-Gurion and Ben-Zvi asked themselves, what happened to those who remained? And when the exiled Jews returned, they found the Sumerians who claimed to be the original Jews. And many of those converted to Islam or to Christianity in later years. But Ben-Zvi used to go through Palestinian villages, and he would remark on how similar the languages were, the rituals. There was so much that they had in common, and he was convinced that they were really the same people. And I've often thought that if this could be surfaced a little more, you know, if that lost idea could be brought back, that maybe each side would not see the other as other, but they are the same.
Yeah. The great writer that keeps coming back to me on this whole subject is Victor Hugo in Les Miserables. He toured the battlefield at Waterloo, and he's puzzling, why did Napoleon get beaten in Waterloo? And he ends up with this incredibly wonderful chapter saying it wasn't the leadership, it wasn't the accidents, it wasn't the weather, it wasn't that the Prussians didn't get there in time. The reason Napoleon came down was that God was tired of Napoleon, and he had to get on with a great new century. Yeah. So we had to get Napoleon off the stage. I keep feeling that about the Middle East. If there was some great board of directors or God that wanted to get on with the 21st century, he'd say, first, we gotta resolve this. This is 50, 60, 70 years of contention about a little bit of real estate. We've got enough real estate lawyers in the world to figure this out and get on with it. And we're not going to, as long as this is bleeding our morale, our thinking, our sense of ourselves.
Well, I often reflect on this because I'm the same age as Israel. I was born in 1947, which is the year that the UN decided to partition Palestine into a state for Jews and a state for the Palestinians. And, you know, we often think that, you know, this conflict between Arabs and Jews is eternal and entitled to go on forever and ever. But in my lifetime, I was born and raised in the segregated South, and we have a black man president now. It was an era of apartheid. It was an era of the Cold War. And now the Soviet Union is dissolved, and all of these things seem to be immutable. They would never change, but they did change. And I think one of the big obstacles when we start thinking about the Middle East is our own pessimism, that nothing can change. As long as we have that in our mind, then we don't even try to make the changes. And if we don't make the changes, then the elevation of violence and the spread of violence will only grow into a greater conflagration. Peace is really hard, and it's kind of miserable in a way. You know, there's an unsatisfied portion of the human spirit that wants to, you know, to have a clear victory. But if you're a student of war in the Middle East, you know the conclusion you have to draw is that one war just prepares the ground for the next. There's no such thing as permanent peace or permanent victory or permanent defeat. It's just a constant interval between wars.
Lawrence Wright's book, based on his play with the same name, is 13 Days in September, Carter, Begin, and Sadat at Camp David. Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation. Connor Gillies recorded it at my house in Boston. Max Larkin helped us prepare for it. Listeners, please pitch in with your own takes on the risks and rewards of peace, then and now, at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project.